for Leologos Radio, the weekly radio program featuring the best in Greek music and culture, plus interviews with Greek and international newsmakers. Leologos Radio with Michael Nevaralekis begins now. This is the Leologos Radio, the worldwide Greek radio program which airs on 20 radio stations across 5 countries, 4 continents, and online. My name is Michael Nevaralekis, and today on our broadcast, which is the final one of the 2015-2016 broadcast season, we will feature, as part of the Leologos interview series, an exclusive interview with New York Times bestselling author, investigative journalist, filmmaker, economist, and friend of the Leologos Radio, Greg Palast, who will speak to us about his new documentary film project on electoral fraud in the United States, about recent developments in Latin America, and about the latest austerity measures passed in Greece and his reactions to what is happening in the country. And following the interview, stay tuned for our commentary of the week, plus some great Greek music throughout today's broadcast. Coming up now, though, is the Leologos interview series and our interview with Greg Palast here on Leologos Radio. The Leologos Interview Series, our weekly segment featuring interviews on matters pertaining to Greece and the worldwide Greek community. Coming up next here on Leologos Radio. Joining us today here on Leologos Radio for this week's edition of the Leologos Interview Series is one of our regular and most prominent guests, investigative reporter, filmmaker, and best-selling author Greg Palast, author of books such as Vulture's Picnic, Armed Madhouse, and The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Greg, thanks for taking time out of your hectic schedule to join us once again.
You're very welcome, anytime.
You've been spending the past few months on a road, from what I understand, as part of your new film project, taking an investigative look at the state of democracy and election fraud in the United States today. What have you been seeing over the course of the primary season these past few months?
It's very interesting because the news that we get, at least in America, doesn't reflect what's going on in the street. We've had, obviously, revolution in both parties, a nonviolent revolution. In the Republican Party, you have Donald Trump, who has been playing a strong populist line. That is, he's anti-corporate. He has said that companies that move jobs overseas are going to be punished, and strongly in favor of maintaining social safety nets such as pensions and Medicare and health insurance. And this is very much not Republican. The leaders and the billionaires who run the Republican Party aren't happy with this. He's also, unfortunately, selling a very racist line. He's saying that no Muslims, zero, should be allowed into the United States for now because it could all be terrorists, which is pretty funny because Trump, remember, owns casinos. And without the Arab sheikhs coming into his casinos and losing millions of dollars, he would go bankrupt. So you know, it's all political chit-chat. And then also he wants to build a wall along the border with Mexico to keep Mexicans from running into the United States illegally, which is also, there's a certain dark humor in that, which is that almost everyone who is in the United States who does not have legal papers to stay here, almost everyone flew in. And most come from Asia, some from Europe, very few from Mexico. They don't, you know, I guess he just saw an old copy of the film Viva Zapata with the Mexicans running across the border and horses. And so if he's going to build a wall, it's going to have to be at least 40,000 feet high because, as I say, most people just fly in and then stay. And keep in mind, as you know, from the very large Greek community in the United States is an entire nation of immigrants. Unless you're a Navajo Indian, you're an immigrant or children of immigrants or grandchildren of immigrants, including Donald Trump, by the way. So that's what's going on. But what we're not getting in the news, what I've been investigating, and will be in my new film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, what will be in that film is the story of how they are trying to manipulate the vote and steal the vote in America. That's the big uncovered story.
Let's give a little bit of background regarding the story, beginning with what happened in Florida back in the 2000 elections. How did those elections set the stage for what we see today, such as electronic voting machines, electoral fraud, and the disenfranchisement of voters, particularly poor and minority voters?
Yes, well, back in the year 2000, that's when George W. Bush was first elected. But he really wasn't elected. He lost the vote because the nasty secret of American democracy is that we don't count all the votes. By all modern measures, we have one of the most corrupted and least trustworthy voting systems in the Western world. Now, for example, in 2000, when I was working for The Guardian newspaper and BBC out of England, I discovered that the person in charge of counting the votes in Florida was a Republican official who not only was in charge of recording the votes, but was also the chairwoman of Bush's election campaign. Before the election, she removed 56,000 black people, African Americans, from the voter roll. Citizens said that they couldn't vote. What was the reason? She said that they were convicted of crimes and therefore they couldn't vote. As it turns out, none of these black people were criminals. Not a single one. But they all lost their right to vote. Almost none of them were going to vote for George Bush. But that's how Bush became president of the United States. People have to understand, out of over 100 million votes cast, George Bush won the presidency by just 537 votes. Now, that election was pure stolen. I uncovered it. In 2004, Bush stole it again, and I uncovered that. Now, today, I'm working with Rolling Stone magazine, and I've uncovered a brand new gimmick called CrossCheck, and they are literally removing another million people from the voter rolls of the United States. And you have to understand, we have a very strange system called the electoral voting system, which makes vote theft fairly easy and makes it profitable, because if you win a single state in America, you get all of its votes. And so even if you win a state by 200 votes, you get all of its electoral votes for choosing the president. Now, it's a little complicated, but the point of that is that when they remove 1 million voters from such states as Ohio and North Carolina and Florida, these are the states that determine who becomes our president. And it doesn't matter who gets the most votes in the United States. It's the matter of these strange electoral votes. And that's how they're stealing it. What they're doing is they've got a new gimmick to remove people from the voter rolls secretly, quietly. People don't even know that they've been removed from the voter rolls. And about a third of Americans mail in their ballots, send them in by mail. And if their vote isn't counted, they don't know it. Americans don't know if their votes even get counted. Officially, we know that about 6 million votes never get counted, and that's the official word. The thing is that almost all the votes removed are votes of poor people, African Americans, the Latino Americans, and Asian Americans, and poor people. These are all basically Democratic voters. Of the 6 million votes lost, there's about a 4 million vote lost to the Democratic candidates, not only the president, but the United States Senate, which is up for grabs. So even though the Republican Party does not like Donald Trump, the problem is that they still have to control the election process and steal votes because they need to control the United States Senate, which is very much up for grabs in this election.
We are on the air with best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Palast here on the Alagos Radio and the Alagos Interview Series. And Greg, all of this, of course, is leading up to your new film project, a crowdsourced documentary titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is also the name of one of your books. Tell us more about the project and also how interested listeners might be able to support it.
Well, there's two things going on. One, the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is a big international bestseller, was about the theft of these elections in America, how it just doesn't stop and it's gotten worse. So the film is actually, even though it's about a grim subject, most of it is quite a lot of fun. That is following me around as an investigative reporter from state to state, seeing how many votes they're stealing. And you get to meet the guys who are stealing the votes. You also meet their victims. But the important thing is the subtitle is called A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. Billionaires and Ballot Bandits is another book I wrote. And the important thing is who's buying these elections. In other words, it's very expensive to steal elections. It's very expensive to get elected, but it's even more expensive to go through the process of stealing votes. And so we hunt down the guys behind the vote theft, billionaires like David and Charles Koch and their brother Billy, who's often forgotten, Billy Koch. We go after a guy named Paul Singer, known as the Vulture, a major vulture investor, who, if you read my new book, just translated into Greek, Vulture's Picnic, you get to meet Paul Singer, the Vulture, a very important character, a financial marauder, a financial pirate. He is behind the vote theft as well. He's funding these efforts to block Black and Latino and poor voters from voting. And that's the game. These billionaires have an agenda. They're going to help Republicans get elected, but they don't really care about the Republican Party. They care about their own bank accounts. They don't care about the political philosophy of any of these candidates. In fact, some of them are Democrats themselves, but they're going to support the theft of the election by the Republicans, especially for the United States Senate.
Let's take a look now at Latin America, where we've seen the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, the electoral loss of President Kirchner in Argentina, and the election of a neoliberal pro-US government. Plus, we've seen the opposition score a major victory in the recent senatorial elections in Venezuela, putting the already destabilized Maduro government in further jeopardy. What's your take on what is happening in South America?
The answer is oil. Venezuela was rebuilding its nation by spreading its oil wealth. Hugo Chavez, before he died, when he was president, directed a massive shift in the nation's wealth from a small group of the white elite. They didn't even call themselves Venezuelans. They called themselves Spaniards. And he took the money away from the white elite and spread it out amongst the poor people, the Black and Indian population, as he called them, because he was Black and Indian, as he told me. I know Chavez well. And if you go to gregpalast.com, you can download for free my film, The Assassination of Hugo Chavez. It's about the political assassination of Chavez. So what happened is with the collapse of oil prices, there was no way to continue this program of redistributing wealth unless you now start taking it away from the rich people. So now the rich are in revolt. So you have a revolution of the rich in Venezuela. And of course, because there's no money left in the treasury with oil prices destroyed for Venezuela in which the nation lives, the current government, any government, would have a tough time surviving that. Same thing in Brazil. Brazil, which was becoming a major oil producer, suffered not only the collapse of oil prices, but suffered the collapse of its commodities, which it sold to China. As China's economy has slowed, Brazil's economy has died. And so, of course, the government in power, once again, a leftist government, has been under attack. They're impeaching the president, Dilma Rousseff. But I can tell you, I've been down to Brazil many times. The particular problem with Rousseff is that she has never been a politician, never held public office until she was elected president, and she just is the worst politician. So she just literally does not know how to speak to the people. I see that in Venezuela. President Maduro, who I know personally, he's a wonderful guy, but he's not a politician, has no idea how to speak to his nation. So you've got two non-politicians who are suddenly running governments in crisis mode. And then finally in Argentina, and this is a situation that's very close to the Greek situation, we had the Kirchner governments, two presidents, Cristina and Nestor Kirchner, who were presidents, a family just like the Clintons or the Bushes. And they had fought very hard not to pay the vultures who took over the debt when the nation was poor. And they took a very, very different route from Greece. When they had a financial crisis, because their governments, their military governments, had bought the entire neoliberal program of austerity and privatization and liberalization of their markets and open markets, just like Greece, the economy of Argentina collapsed. But then the leftist governments of Nestor, then Cristina Kirchner, took over. They rejected the neoliberal programs. They moved away from austerity. They tightened their regulations. They deprivatized and renationalized their critical industries like electricity and water and oil. And the government thrived. Suddenly the nation thrived by rejecting the whole neoliberal austerity program. In fact, the banks that were owed money ended up getting their money. People don't realize that while Argentina declared a default, in the end, the banks that they owed money to got their money because the economy grew. That this is really very much applies to the situation of Greece. If someone is dying, the solution is not to bleed, you know, it's like medieval to be bleeding a nation economically when it's wounded. You know, that's why Argentina was dying and that got reversed when austerity was rejected. Obviously, that didn't happen in Greece. So as you're wounded, you're also being bled at the same time. Now, what's happened in Argentina is that a few vulture investors, as they're called, bought up some of the old debts of Argentina back from the military dictatorship. They paid $50 million. A guy named Paul the Vulture Singer, he's known as the Vulture, he paid about $50 million for debt, bonds of the Argentine government, and then said he demanded $3 billion after paying $50 million for the debt. The Kirchner government refused. And he held out, he used U.S. law to strangle the nation of Argentina, to prevent it from getting funds from the IMF, to prevent the nation from borrowing, to seize the assets of the nation, including its Navy ships on the high seas. It seized its satellite rockets, the Vultures, the types of things that are threatened of Greece if you dare declare a default. But remember, the Vultures never lent money to Argentina. And the vulture investors never lent money to Greece. These guys just buy up old debts at a discount and then hold the nation economically hostage for ransom. And unfortunately, in the case of Argentina, it worked. They were strangling the economy, destroying the economy. So then the leftist government, which said, we will never pay these vultures, ended up getting thrown out of office. And a new right-wing government just wrote a check to the vultures for $6 billion. So they basically gave up the Argentine treasury to these vultures who paid $50 million for bonds. You're talking about a 3,000% profit. It is obscene. It's horrible. And by the way, it reflects on the U.S. election because Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama opposed the vulture attack on Argentina and said this guy is a threat to world finance, the vulture and his friends. And it carries way over to Greece because I have to tell you that Paul Singer, the vulture in Argentina, it turns out people thought he was behind the vulture attack, the financial attack on Greece. It wasn't. It was, it turns out, the Bass brothers who were his partners in Argentina, attacking Argentina. And these are the guys who were threatening Greece and they got paid by your government. You have no money, but they've been paid.
We are speaking with best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Palast here on the Alagos Radio and in the Alagos interview series. And before we talk more about Greece, we've seen a similar crisis unfold in recent years in Puerto Rico, and a crisis that is only now reaching the limelight. Puerto Rico, of course, is not an independent country. It is a U.S. colony. Yet there are many similarities with what we see in Greece and elsewhere in Latin America. What is your take on what is happening in Puerto Rico today, on the role of the vulture funds, and how the U.S. government is responding to the issue?
This is fascinating because Puerto Rico is one of America's last colonies. A lot of Republicans, a lot of people feared making them a state. But this is the interesting thing. All the people of Puerto Rico are American citizens. Puerto Rico, as a semi-independent state, got into trouble, just like Greece, because Puerto Rico, like Greece, stuck to the euro. Puerto Rico is stuck to the U.S. dollar. It's a Caribbean nation. So remember, Puerto Rico has to compete economically with Haiti, with Trinidad, with Jamaica, but it has the U.S. dollar, just like you have the euro. And so what's happened is that the Puerto Rican economy has been dying. And so people are fleeing Puerto Rico. Probably nearly half of the population of Puerto Rico now lives in the United States proper, in New York and Florida mainly. So what's happened is the economy of Puerto Rico has died because it's stuck with the U.S. dollar, just like Greece is stuck with the euro and has suffered. The difference is that there's a real debate in the United States between paying off not only the banks, but also these same vulture investors have gotten involved. Paul Singer's vulture partner, a guy named John Paulson, is now the big holder and Vulture holding the bonds and debts of Puerto Rico. So what's happened is that a great number of American politicians and the government of Barack Obama, the Democratic Party, have called for a very un-German solution, which is to allow Puerto Rico to declare bankruptcy and to cut down and eliminate, agree not to pay most of its debts, and to refinance its debts with help from the U.S. government. And this is not like the IMF, where they are demanding all kinds of cuts and austerity. However, that's the Obama administration's position. The position of the Republican Party, for the most part, is to basically do what the Germans are doing to Greece, demand massive austerity, massive layoffs of public employees, privatization of the electric company, and all these various same measures, cutting the pensions, all the same things that Greece is going through, the demand for austerity. So right now, part of the election fight is over whether the Vultures win or the people of Puerto Rico. But at least the majority, and I want to emphasize this, the majority of people in the United States do not feel like the Germans. The majority of people in the United States think that Puerto Rico is still part of America and therefore deserves, that the people of Puerto Rico deserve to be treated as Americans and therefore not be destroyed economically. So it's a fierce battle, just like you have in Greece, except in Greece, it's a battle between your people, your government, the IMF, and the Germans. And in the U.S., it's a battle between the people of Puerto Rico, the Vulture investors again, and the Republican and Democratic parties. So there's a lot of Democrats who are anti-Puerto Rico and a lot of Republicans who are in favor of helping Puerto Rico. The problem is that the Vultures are supporting the Republican Party. And that's, remember, even with a Democratic president, we have a Republican Congress, and they're holding up a solution for Puerto Rico, just like the Germans are holding up a solution for Greece.
Looking now at Greece, recently the Syriza-led government passed further sets of strict austerity measures targeting the country's pension and tax systems and mortgaging the country's public assets to foreign lenders for the next 99 years. Greece, of course, remains in a eurozone, and there's no discussion or debate at governmental levels in Greece about an exit from the eurozone or the European Union. What's your reaction to these latest developments in Greece?
Well, basically, the Syriza government lied to the Greek people. It ran on a platform of saying, we will get a good deal from Europe or we will leave the euro. And they had a lot of power and a lot of leverage when they came in. There was a great deal of panic about Greece leaving the euro that could have been used to squeeze concessions. But concessions are somewhat meaningless in one way. As long as you're in the eurozone, you are chained to the German economy. And you're chained to Germany's need for higher interest. You're chained to Germany's need to maintain high employment at a cost to the rest of the eurozone. That's what's going on. In other words, as long as you have this ridiculously high currency, you can't compete against Turkey. You know, you're getting some of the tourism back now, but only at a devastating cost to your wages. And so I think what's happening now is because there's now the whole idea of leaving the eurozone is completely lost. It's one of those things where you say, we should have done it a year ago. We should have done it a year ago. We should have done it a year ago. Every year you say you should have done it a year ago. It is very late. A high price has already been paid, but it's still not the end of the price you will be paying, because if you don't leave the eurozone, you are going to be stuck. And unlike the United States, where Puerto Rico is stuck with the U.S. dollar, there's an understanding that the American government has to be responsible for this nation basically chained to its dollar. There's no sense of responsibility to Greece by the European Union. It's not a union. The European Union is not anything close to a union in any manner. It is an occupation, and I don't say that lightly. You had a Greek elite which was more than happy to combine with this tremendous outside pressure force. And don't forget that the plunder of Greece's assets is not just by Germans or foreigners. The plunder includes the takeover of a lot of your assets by some rich Greeks as well, who saw this as a way to pry golden assets out of the government. And of course, did that help? I mean, you're constantly being told that austerity would save you, and it hasn't. The definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. Austerity is an idea that is dangerous and failed. It really is. As Joe Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, told me, it's completely medieval. The idea that bleeding an economy, cutting your pensions, cutting your wages, selling off more, is going to improve your economy is insane. You keep doing it and it doesn't work for a very simple reason. When you cut people's pensions and you cut people's wages and you eliminate government employment and you eliminate employment in the shipping industry, you end up with people who don't have money to spend. And if people don't spend money, your economy dies. It is not surprising that when you slash and bleed an economy, that it starts bleeding to death. And now your government, your parliament decided to go along with more austerity, but it's not good enough for the Germans. And the Germans aren't demanding austerity because it's good for you, or it's even good for the Eurozone, because they know. They know this will drag down Greece further. They absolutely know it. Even the IMF, which is an organization which is infamous for its insane cruelty, even the IMF says this is too cruel. It's as if Pinochet, the dictator, says, I can't watch this torture anymore. I mean, even the IMF said this is insane. You know, Christine Lagarde, she's even saying this is madness. This will just make it impossible for Greece to recover. And if you look at the program that they have in mind for Greece, they don't expect, they're not even promising recovery anymore. They're saying that you are going to be in an austerity mode for the next 20 years. That's not true. You will be in the austerity mode forever. This is a permanent change in your wages, permanent change in control, permanent change in ownership, unless you get the hell out of the Eurozone. Yes, it's too late, but it's not too late. It should have been done before, but it's got to be done now. And it will happen. It will happen. Either the Eurozone collapses and joins Greece, or Greece, ironically, is going to be shoved out of the Eurozone when they decide that you're just too costly to keep around.
We are on the air with best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Palast here on the Alagos Radio and the Alagos interview series. And Greg, we've discussed the list in past interviews, but I believe it bears repeating. He had spoken to the founding father, if you will, of the euro, economist Robert Mundell. What did he have to say about the European common currency and its true objectives?
This is very important. The man who invented the euro is the economist Robert Mundell, who I've had long discussions with. Mundell said absolutely straight blankly, and by the way, he's not a European, he's a Canadian-American who lives in New York. And he said the creation of the euro was a way to bring the supply side economics of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher to the continent. By creating a euro, he said, you take away fiscal power, monetary power from any government. So if you're ever in trouble, you can't use stimulus spending. You can't change the value of your currency. He said, therefore, the only thing that's left for you to do is to cut government employment, cut wages, eliminate union power, and privatize industry. Just so you understand, what happened in Greece was not a mistake, was not a problem of the euro. It was the program of the euro. It's the purpose of the euro. What happened to Greece is what Mundell had in mind and the creators of the euro had in mind, which is to break your unions, take your properties, etc. Now, understand, is Mundell some type of crazy berserker? No, he's a Nobel Prize winning economist. He was the man who created supply side economics for Ronald Reagan, which is some now known as voodoo economics. And so he actually believed that in the long run, this would be better for Europe and Greece to get rid of labor unions, to get rid of public employment, and basically eliminate all kinds of regulations, which he thought were strangling the economy. This is an old right-wing Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher view of world economics, which is now long discredited. But while supply-side economics is now roundly considered a failed, wrong economic philosophy, an experiment that was disastrously wrong worldwide, you're still stuck with the supply-side chain, the supply-side prison known as the Eurozone. That's the problem. Basically, the euro is simply a tool to enforce supply side right wing economics. And everyone is getting hurt by this, except the Germans, who have reorganized their economy to be an export machine, because they have, for them, the currency is priced too low. So they have a tremendous export advantage and they use it. So they are the export machine and you are the victims.
Now, before we wrap up, let's talk about your most recent book, Vulture's Picnic, which has finally circulated in Greece with a Greek language translation. What can our listeners expect to read in this book?
First of all, think of it as a real life detective story. I call it pulp nonfiction. And so it reads like a detective story because it is. And you follow me as a detective through such things as the Greek financial crisis, where we uncovered such things as the tremendous an ugly influence of the manipulation of the Greek debt, the hiding of the Greek debt by Goldman Sachs and big banks. And you'll also find such things as what we call the Endgame Memo, which was the original memo of the World Trade Organization written by U.S. Treasury secretaries, which basically became the blueprint for this neoliberal takeover of the world economy. And Greece is its natural victim. And you'll get the whole story about what is behind, what kicked off the, what you call the Greek crisis, but was really the Greek plan. You have to understand the riots. In fact, in the book, the detective, me, Greg Pallast, I end up meeting with this economist, Joe Stiglitz, and he was on the inside. He was the chairman of Bill Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, and he was also the chief economist of the World Bank. And as he laid it out, he explained that this destruction, this squeezing of the economies, was a deliberate plan. And I showed him a document I got. Throughout Vulture's Picnic, you get all these inside documents that I get. I get a lot of confidential documents. And that's what's fun. I get pull these things out of the files. And out of the files of the World Bank and the IMF, I found plans that basically suggested that they knew that their plans would cause riots. And the riots were good because this would allow them to move in the troops, take over the government, and impose their austerity plans. So they were literally trying to provoke riots. I said, it looks like they're trying to provoke riots. Am I reading this correctly? And he said, absolutely. And remember, this was the chief economist of the World Bank. He's inside. He's not guessing. He said, we used to call those the IMF riots. And they liked the riots because the riots would then, just as you had the burning of the bank in Athens and four people died, they love this stuff. I mean, I hate to put it that way. They really love it because when there is riot and commotion and crisis, they move in and impose austerity and people are afraid of insurrection, afraid of civil war. Greece suffered a terrible civil war. No one wants that again. And so people say, okay, we'll go along with the austerity, even though you know you have to be kidding yourself to think that this somehow is going to save you or improve your economy.
Greg, where can our listeners find out more about your books, your film project, and also your podcast?
Where can you get my this information? Number one, read the book. Read Vulture's Picnic, which I'm thrilled is now in Greek. My other books, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and these are have all been translated to several languages. But the important thing is get the story, get the information. Then you can read all my reports for free at gregpalast.com. That's GREGPALAST.com. Please go there and you'll get the latest information on all the hijinks and vote thievery and bad bear billionaires at gregpalast.com. And if you want, you can support this film. It is a film that's nearly complete now, and it has been funded by the public so that we don't owe any commercial interests any money to tell the truth about the U.S. elections. And we'll be putting out a television broadcast, radio broadcast, et cetera. You can get all this information and how to join in producing the film and helping out at gregpalast.com.
Wonderful. Well, Greg, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today here on the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Η εκπομπή Διάλογος τώρα στο iTunes. Μπορείτε να κατεβάσετε όλα τα podcast και να ακούσετε το διαδικτυακό μας ραδιόφωνο Διάλογος Radio όπου και αν βρίσκεστε. Συντονιστείτε.
This is Dialogos Radio, where we just wrapped up the final Dialogos interview series of the broadcast season and our interview with best-selling author, investigative journalist, filmmaker, and economist Greg Palast. The podcast of this interview will soon be available on our website, dialogosmedia.org, on the Dialogos Radio apps for Android, Kindle, BlackBerry, and Chrome, in iTunes, TuneIn.com, in the Windows Store, and in Anobix Radio, WeCast, Player FM, Stitcher, and Podbean apps. Coming up now is our commentary of the week. Dialogos Radio's commentary of the week. Each week, Michael Navratakis provides views and opinions on issues pertaining to Greece and to the worldwide Greek community. Coming up next, here on Dialogos Radio. For this final commentary of the broadcast season, I thought it was time to tell you the truth about Greece. In May, likely for the first time in the post-war history of the Western world, a national parliament willingly ceded what remained of its country's sovereignty, essentially voting itself obsolete. This development, however, did not make headlines in a global news cycle and was ignored by most of the purportedly leftist media. The country, of course, in question is Greece, where a 7,500-page omnibus bill was just passed without parliamentary debate and which transfers control over all of the country's public assets to a fund controlled by the European Stability Mechanism for the next 99 years. To be clear, this includes all public infrastructure, harbors, airports, public beaches, and natural resources, all passed to the control of the ESM, which is a non-democratic, supranational body which answers to no parliamentary or elected body. Within the same bill, the Greek parliament also rendered itself voteless. The legislation annuls the role of the parliament to create a national budget or to pass tax legislation. These decisions will now be made automatically at the behest of the European Union. If fiscal targets set by the EU, the IMF, and the ESM are not met, automatic cuts will be implemented without any parliamentary debate, which could slash anything from social spending, salaries, to pensions. In earlier legislation, the Greek parliament agreed to submit all legislation to the so-called Troika for approval. For historical precedent, one needs to look no further than the Enabling Act passed by the German Reichstag in 1933, where the German parliament voted away its right to exercise legislative power, transferring absolute power to govern and to pass laws to the Chancellor Adolf Hitler. The Greek omnibus bill was preceded by another piece of legislation which reformed Greece's pension system through the enactment of further cuts, while increasing taxes almost entirely across the board. Despite government lies to the contrary, these cuts are regressive and will disproportionately impact the poorer strata of society. The basic pension has been cut to 345 euros per month, supplementary pensions to poor individuals have been eliminated, the value-added tax on many basic goods has been raised to 24%, the number of households which qualify for heating oil subsidies has been slashed in half, while taxes on oil and fuel have again been increased. Copays on prescription drugs covered by public health insurance have been hiked by 25%, employees' contributions to the Social Security Fund have been raised, effectively lowering salaries, special taxes have been introduced on coffee and alcoholic beverages, while Greece's suffering small businesses have been saddled with an increase in their tax rate from 26% to 29%. In addition to the aforementioned pieces of legislation, the Greek government, in effect, ceded its national sovereignty earlier in the year when, as part of the EU-Turkey deal on the refugee and migrant crisis, Greece unconditionally accepted the presence of NATO warships and Turkish military and police personnel in the Aegean region, while the patriotic defense minister of Greece, Panos Kamenos, has publicly proposed the construction of a new NATO base on the island of Karpathos. While Greece has made global headlines times in recent years, the media have remained silent on this latest neoliberal attack on the country's economy and on Greece's already suffering businesses and households. But it has not just been the mainstream media which has been quiet. Supposedly leftist media outlets such as Democracy Now have forgotten about Greece ever since Syriza's betrayal of the July 5th, 2015 referendum result, where an overwhelming majority, 62%, of voters rejected further austerity. Leftist intellectuals such as Noam Chomsky and Naomi Klein have also remained silent. These so-called left-wing outlets and intellectuals had all, at one time, openly supported Syriza, even while the signs were there that Syriza was not what it claimed to be. Today, these outlets and these intellectual figures refuse to admit that they were wrong or to openly denounce Syriza's betrayal, while also not providing any support to other true anti-austerity movements in Greece. Of course, even when Greece was in the news, the truth regarding what was really happening in the country was obscured behind the international media's overwhelming pro-EU, which masqueraded as objective reporting. The economic crisis in Greece has typically been blamed on lazy and unproductive Greeks, who supposedly refused to work, even at their cushy government jobs, retired at age 30, and who lived beyond their means, vacationing in the Greek Isles and spending the money of hard-working Europeans to live the high life. So-called reality television programs such as Live Like a Greek, broadcast on the UK's Channel 4, perpetuated this blatant stereotyping, as did the Greek media back at home. Even the supposedly brilliant anti-austerity crusader Yanis Varoufakis repeated the mythology that hard-working Germans and other Europeans are now paying to support Greece. The reality, however, is harshly different. Greece is not receiving free money from Europe or the Troika. It is receiving loans to repay previous debt, loans which are accompanied by high interest rates and onerous strings attached, such as the aforementioned measures recently passed by the Greek Parliament. Greece's debt as a percentage of GDP was 124% prior to receiving its first so-called bailout in 2010. 6 years later, and after repeatedly being saved, this figure is approaching 200%. What has gone unsaid by both the Greek and international media are the true origins and contributors to the Greek crisis. These factors include the manipulation by Goldman Sachs of Greece's debt and deficit figures through a series of swaps and derivatives, hiding the true figures in circumvention of EU Maastricht criteria for admission into the Eurozone, and all for a tidy profit. Indeed, a piece of often repeated mythology was that Greece was the only country which misbehaved by lying to enter the Eurozone. In fact, Goldman Sachs, as well as JP Morgan and other major banks, helped Italy and other countries lie as well. While the role of swaps and derivatives in bringing about the global financial meltdown of 2007-2008 is well known. Manipulation took place in Greece too, at the behest of international lenders. Greece's statistical authority, Elstat, led by former IMF official Andreas Georgiou, is said to have manipulated Greek deficit figures in 2009 to seem worse than they were in reality, with the goal of providing the political impetus necessary to bring in the IMF and other so-called saviors to bail out Greece. These allegations were so serious and so effectively substantiated by Elstat whistleblowers such as Zoe Yorganda, that criminal charges were filed against Georgiou, charges which were quietly dropped by the so-called leftist Syriza government in 2015. The Elstat scandal has barely been reported upon outside of Greece, if at all, while in Greece today it has essentially been forgotten. Another cause of the crisis is the euro itself. The euro is a debt instrument produced by a private bank, the European Central Bank, which is accountable to no government, while the euro is lent to member states such as Greece. The concept of the European Common Currency was first proposed by economist Robert Mundell, who is also known as the father of supply-side economics, and who, in an interview with Greg Palast, had the following to say about the true objectives of the euro. It puts monetary policy out of the reach of politicians, and without fiscal policy, the only way nations can compete is by the competitive reduction of rules on business. The euro was created to strip fiscal and monetary policy-making ability from national governments, leaving them without the ability to increase stimulus spending or devalue their national currency to regain competitiveness. The only option left was austerity and deregulation. What has happened in Greece, therefore, is not an accident or a failure of the euro. It was the goal, as Greg Palast also told us in our interview earlier in today's broadcast. Of course, the Greek and international media will have you believe that Greeks are overwhelmingly pro-euro, gleefully reporting the supposed results of public opinion polls, which have claimed that 70 to 80% of Greeks wish to remain in the euro at all costs. Herein lies a dirty little secret of Greek politics. There are no independent polling firms in Greece. Instead, these firms all receive state funding, and all public opinion polls are conducted on behalf of major media outlets, all of which are politically aligned, and most of which are oligarch-owned. Results are predictably tailored to the desires of these outlets and their owners, but are unquestioningly repeated by the international media and their Greece-based correspondents. What haven't they reported? The results of the annual Gallup International poll, conducted in several European countries, including Greece, which found majorities in Greece in favor of departing the Eurozone in both 2014 and 2015. This poll, conducted across Europe and by a non-Greek firm, is far less likely to be politically tainted. It is nevertheless true, of course, that there is a strong pro-European sentiment in Greece. This mentality is deeply rooted in the country's modern history. Following independence, the so-called Great Powers promptly installed foreign monarchs at Greece's helm. For most of the 19th and early 20th century, Greece was a Bavarian and British protectorate. Following the Greek Civil War, itself prodded by the British, Greece became an American protectorate, capped off by the US-supported military junta of 1967 to 1970. Following the fall of the junta, a conservative government laid the groundwork for Greece to cede its sovereignty as the country joined the European Union in 1981 and the Eurozone in 2002. Greece was also under foreign financial oversight, with the British, French, Germans, Italians, Austrians, and Russians permanently posted in Greece to take a chunk of the country's tax revenues for the repayment of old Ottoman debts from 1898 to 1978. Greece has never been an independent, fully sovereign state, and this reality has created a colonial mindset and fierce divisiveness in the Greek psyche. A division between those who are leftist versus those who are fascist, and a division between those who believe Greece should be aligned with the West and those who wish to align with Russia. Those in favor of true independence and non-alignment are few and far between, while the crisis has brought back to the fore the old societal divisions. Last summer, the Greek people voted overwhelmingly to reject the austerity proposals in last July's referendum. But what exactly was the referendum asking? The question on the ballot was purposely convoluted, while the Syriza-led government did not present its planned course of action should the no vote have prevailed. This should have served as a warning. Tsipras, as well as Varoufakis, could barely conceal their disappointment that no prevailed, and so overwhelmingly, and neither could the media and the polling firms, which predicted that no and yes were running neck and neck, just as their electoral exit polls dating back to 2010 have been woefully inaccurate and always in a pro-austerity direction. The lead-up to the referendum also saw a tremendous wave of so-called solidarity throughout Europe and the West, with activists purportedly supporting the Greek people, and, somehow, supplied with Syriza flags, which I am sure one can't just easily purchase in a shop in London or New York City. Oddly enough, following the betrayal, this so-called solidarity movement dissipated. Gee, I wonder why. The protest movement in Greece is not much better. While a general perception exists across the globe that Greeks have not been afraid to riot and to strike for their rights, the reality is far more mundane, unfortunately. Complacency, apathy, and resignation are the name of the game in Greece. Every so often, when a protest is organized, the same old stale, ineffective recipes are followed. Gather in Syntagma Square, stand around in front of Parliament with the same old banners, wait for the so-called rioters to appear in a tear gas to start flying, and then retreat. And just who are these rioters? The media calls them anarchists, but a plethora of documentary evidence suggests that these are provocateurs who are working in cahoots with the police and who are sent in to orchestrate trouble in otherwise peaceful gatherings, providing the impetus for police to fire tear gas, not at the hoodlums, of course, but at the crowd that had gathered peacefully, thereby breaking up the protest. Numerous videos and photos have shown these provocateurs mingling with police officers or smashing shop windows in front of police, unobstructed. I've seen this with my very own eyes. Hooded men in civilian clothing mingling with police behind the U.S. Embassy in Athens during a protest in 2012. In the rare event that a demonstration gathers large crowds, as was the case during the protests of the so-called indignants in 2011, or the rallies in favor of no prior to last July's referendum, this is invariably because partisan armies have been mobilized to show up in large numbers. A dirty secret of the large-scale 2011 protests is that they very well may have been staged to serve as a release valve for an increasingly disenchanted populace. An official now with the Independent Greeks political party, which had not yet formed back in 2011, claimed in an interview I conducted for my academic research in 2012 that he was the one behind the original Facebook invitation which led to the beginning of the indignance movement in Greece. When I asked why the Facebook page was later taken down, his reply was that it no longer served a purpose. Similarly, while large crowds and celebrity musicians were mobilized in the days leading up to last year's referendum, following the referendum and betrayal, the number of protesters in Syntagma Square did not surpass a few hundred. The partisan armies stayed home. Similarly, the mobilization of Greek farmers recently was halted once party-affiliated union bosses got involved, sending the farmers back home. There's a lot more that I could say, and that I will say, in the published version of this commentary, which will soon be available on dialogosmedia.org and elsewhere, but in the interest of time, I will say this about the Greek people. For years, you kept saying that you wanted Europe, wanted the Euro, wanted to be European, and wanted to live the European dream. Well, how do you like that European dream now? Thank you, and have a good summer.
Follow Dialogos Radio on Facebook and Twitter and remain connected to all our latest news and updates. Check us out today at facebook.com/dialogosmedia and at twitter.com/dialogosmedia.
Κάποιο παράθυρο έχει φως, κάποιον τον τρώει ο πύρετος, μας φεύγει βήμα-βήμα. Κάποιο καράβι στα νύχτα, με χίλια βάσανα βαστά, να μην το πιει το κύμα. Και εμείς οι τρεις στον καφέ, ναι, τσιγάρο πρέφα και καφέ, βρε δε βαριέ, βρε δε βαριέσαι αδερφέ. Και εμείς οι τρεις στον καφέ, ναι, τσιγάρο πρέπα και καφέ, βρε δε βαριέ, βρε δε βαριέσαι, αδερφέ. Κάποιος στην άκρη του γκρεμού κοιτάει το τέλος του ουρανού, μονάχος του πεθαίνει. Κάποιος στη μάχη πολεμά, η σφαίρα δίπλα μας περνά, στα στήθια του πηγαίνει. Κι εμείς οι άλλοι ματωνέ, κάνουμε πάρτι ρε φωνέ, βρε δε βαριέ, βρε δε βαριέσαι αδερφέ. Κι εμείς οι άλλοι ματωνέ, κάνουμε πάρτι ρε φαινέ, βρε δε βαριέσαι, δε βαριέσαι αδερφέ. Έξω αστράφτη και βροντά κι ένας διαβάτης περπατά χαμένος μες στην πόρα. Κάπου δε θα έχουνε ψωμί, κάπου πεινάει ένα παιδί και κλαίει αυτή την ώρα. Και εμείς χορτάτι ματωνέ, κάνουμε γλέντια ρε φαινέ, βρε δε βαριέσαι, δε βαριέσαι αδερφέ. Και εμείς χορτάτι ματωνέ, κάνουμε πάρτι ρε φαινέ, βρε δε βαριέσαι, βρε δε βαριέσαι αδερφέ. Αχ, πόσοι απόψε ξαγρυπνούν σαν κολλασμένοι τριγυρνούν και κλαίνε και πονάνε. Στάσου και σκέψου μια στιγμή πόσοι σκοτώνονται στη γη την ώρα που μιλάμε. Και εμείς, οι τρεις στον καφενέ, τσιγάρο, πρέφα και καφέ. Βρε δεν βαριέσαι, αδερφέ. Και εμείς οι τρεις στον καφενέ, τσιγάρο, πρέφα και καφέ. Βρε δε βαριέσαι, αδερφέ.
Take the Dialogos Radio on the go with you with the new Dialogos Radio app for Android devices. Now you can listen live to the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos Radio 24/7, download our podcasts, and read our latest articles all in our free Android app, available now in the Google Play Store. We just heard Kostas Hadzis with De Variese Aderfe here on the Dialogos Radio, where earlier we wrapped up our commentary of the week. This is the final Dialogos Radio broadcast of the 2015-2016 season, and at this time I would like to take the opportunity to thank the behind-the-scenes Dialogos Radio volunteer staff, Kostadinos Papatheodosiou and the Star Radio Network, the Iroi online radio station, all of our guests and contributors over the course of this past season, and of course you, our listeners, friends, and supporters. We will be back on the air in the fall, and until then, be sure to regularly visit our website, dialogosmedia.org, where we will continue to post articles and commentaries, where you can find our podcasts and program archives, and where you can listen to our online radio station, Dialogos Radio 24/7. We will close out today's broadcast with our traditional summer farewell song, Kalokeragi by Fatmeh. Thank you for joining us today and throughout this past season, and we will be back again this fall. Until then, have a wonderful summer.
Το καλοκαιράκι στην ακρογιαλιά, μέσα στο νεράκι πλέουμε αγκαλιά. Πέφτει το βραδάκι, πιάνει η δροσιά. Δώσ' μου ένα φυλάκι και έλα πιο κοντά. Εγώ κι εσύ, εσύ κι εγώ, μόνοι πάνω στη γη. Μόνοι στη γη. Εγώ κι εσύ, εσύ κι εγώ, μόνοι πάνω στη γη. Μόνοι στη γη. Ήταν η Αθήνα, όμως στο λαιμό, με φως και ρουτίνα και άγχος τρόμερο. Δώσ' μου ένα τσιγάρο, δώσ' μου και φωτιά. Θεέ μου, θα σε πάρω στην καυτή την αμμουδιά. Εγώ κι εσύ, εσύ κι εγώ, μόνοι πάνω στη γη.
εσύ, εσύ κι εγώ, μόνοι πάνω στη γη. Μόνοι στη γη. Τηλέφωνο χτυπάει, βουλιάζει το νησί και το όνειρο σκορπάει στου γραφείου τη βουή.
Μετάβομαι δορμένος, δουλεύεις και γελάς. Σ' ακούω σαν χαμένος, το ρεφρέν να τραγουδάς.
Εγώ κι εσύ, εσύ κι εγώ, μόνοι πάνω στη γη. Μόνοι στη γη. Εγώ κι εσύ, εσύ κι εγώ, μόνοι πάνω στη γη. Μόνοι στη γη. Εγώ κι εσύ, εσύ κι εγώ, μόνοι πάνω στη γη. Μόνοι στη γη. Εγώ κι εσύ, εσύ κι εγώ.